Game over, man. Game over.
You're gonna need a bigger boat. I'm so serious.
I am Iron Man.
This is a tasty burger.
Welcome to the In Session Film Podcast.
Hello, everyone, and welcome back to the In Session Film Podcast. I'm Ryan McQuaid.
And I'm Jay Ledbetter.
Thank you for coming back and joining the show, returning for our next review here for our One Car Away movie series. We took a week off, Jay, but we're back.
You took a week.
But you didn't do it without me, so technically you took the
forced
week off. Well, I mean,
you went on strike.
Listen, you guys had to pay my demands, and I think that we all agreed on the right terms, and
you got your pay raise that you wanted.
I got what I wanted.
Yes, at the end of the day, you're the true winner.
Listen, I got the Infinity Stones I wanted, and at any point I'll snap, and we're going to lose half the co-hosts. We already lost one.
All right, I'm making a rule right now. We're not allowed to bring up anything Marvel related on our One Car Why movie series.
What are you talking about? It's all cinema.
Nipping that one in the bud right now.
It was an innocent joke.
The Infinity Stones, the color scheme was inspired by that of In the Mood for Love.
Yeah, I was going to say they're all inspired by the cinematography for every one of these films in One Car Why.
That's so true.
We've had blue, we've had green, we've had like what is that? What would you say this one is more natural, I guess?
This is like a teal.
Like a teal, right?
Maybe some oranges thrown in there.
Yeah. I feel like, you know, what would
be
purple?
Is
you
a think, decent way to put
You think
it.
My blueberry nights will be purple? Kind of for like a blueberry pie, you know?
Nora Jones is in it. It might be blue because her music makes me sad.
It does. Does it make you sad? Does it put you to sleep?
One in the same.
Yeah. No, that's fair. I can't wait to talk about that one. We have a guest lined up for that one, too. That's going to be a fun one. But yes, I was at South by Southwest last week, and Jay was here. You've been doing a bunch of things. You got to review Shazam. What are you talking about? You've had a great time.
That's a good point. At the end of the day, I guess I was actually the true winner.
Yeah. Technically all of the listeners and all of our new wonderful watchers on YouTube, all of our followers here on YouTube, they were the ones that were the winners because they got to see you review that wonderful film, right? Your favorite film of the year so far.
Yeah, that was what's the opposite of a palate cleanser? It's like it's like you get your nice One Car Why appetizer.
It's like putting a bag of sand in your mouth and eating it.
And then they bring you the spoiled lettuce from the trash can doused in hot sauce. And
do you think that so that lettuce was expired?
Nice transition to Chungking
what you're
Express.
Saying. Yeah, the lettuce was expired.
Well, certainly the DC Universe, as we know it, is past its expiration date. And this movie, actually was the basis for them canceling the DC Universe. It was an homage to Chungking Express, which is all
I think
about
we should make another lines. Rule. I think we should make another rule that we can't mention the DCEU anymore on any one of these ones.
All right, let's see. Yeah. You know what? Fair. Fair.
You're going to make me. I said something innocent, and then now you've gone on a rabbit hole about the DCEU.
I would never.
You would never do that. That's not
I would
you.
Never.
But no, it's been. We haven't done this in a week, and we're already kicking off in a great fashion. But yeah, we're here to talk about Chungking Express, which is where we left off in our Wong Kar-wai movie series. And of course, it is directed by Wong Kar-wai, and it stars Bridget Lin and Tony Leung and Fei Young and many others. I'm just not going to butcher names today. I'm sure Fair Jay enough. And I will later throughout. But Jay, this movie is about two melancholy Hong Kong policemen who fall in love. One mysteriously with a female underground figure, and the other is a beautiful waitress at a late night restaurant that he frequents. So, Jay, this one's kind of a big one in the series, to be fair, because this one is on the old Sight and Sounds list. This is, I believe, at like number 86, if I'm not mistaken, on the new Sight and Sounds list. He's got two films that are on the list. One that we'll talk about in a couple weeks, In the Mood for Love. But this is the other one. And this is a a pretty revolutionary film for a lot of filmgoers, especially of our age. People found this film. I know that I've listened to a bunch of podcasts where people found this in college and were kind of blown away by the directorial and storytelling flair that Wong Kar-wai presents here in this film. So I am curious from your perspective, since I know you watched this a couple of months ago.
No, I haven't. This is the first.
Oh, you didn't? Oh, okay.
Watch. No, I only watched the first couple.
The running
couple.
Joke, the lot, yeah, was that yeah. you had started yeah. it, and then, you know, and no, then you that, had to rewatch
that rabbit
all
hole
stuff.
Was shallow.
Oh, okay. It was very shallow. So it was just those two? Was it just those two? Okay.
Correct.
So this was a first time watch, and you've yes. had plenty of time. We've had a couple weeks to simmer yeah. on Chungking Express to buy a ticket and travel down this road to this review. So without further ado, Jay, what are your thoughts on Chungking Express?
You know, you're right. This is a big one. This is the movie that really put Wong Kar-wai on the map internationally. Mm-hmm. You know, mm-hmm. he had been fairly established, although not seen a tremendous amount of commercial success in Hong Kong. But this one was when the whole world started paying attention to director Wong. And the fascinating thing about that is he kind of made this movie on a whim. We're going to talk about Ashes of Time next week. And
yeah.
that movie was actually shot significantly earlier mm-hmm. than this film was shot. But in an interview with Wong, he said that they were waiting on some sort of sound equipment to mess with the sound for Ashes of Time. And he was yeah. just like, I don't have anything to do for a while. I'm just going to make a movie. Because
isn't that kind of like the Spielberg of it all, too, with like Spielberg, because the, if I'm not mistaken, obviously also the rush to make Schindler's List, but the technology of Jurassic Park just took such a long time that he was able right. to, before they could finish making that film, he had to go, he went and made another great film in his filmography. So it's not too rare that this happens, but it is when you're on like strict budgets and timelines and things, I guess, and,
right.
and especially to international demands too and everything.
And when at the time you're not a super successful guy with a lot of clout
yes.
who can just go get money to make a movie. But
yeah.
in this instance, he did. He was like, I'm going to scale it down after the big epic of Ashes of Time. I think he kind of wanted to just go back to more of his roots, that smaller scale work that we're accustomed to seeing from him, yeah. the very personal stories. And weirdly, and we'll talk about Ashes of Time next week, but
we'll
I
talk
see
about
a lot,
the extended cut or the theatrical cut. No, are you going to talk about
the theatrical cut? Yeah. Well, I've watched yeah. the other one. I'm planning on watching I've watched the director's cut. I'm planning on watching the original cut as well. But
and so wait, which one is the one he prefers?
I assume he prefers the director's cut, which is 10 minutes shorter and has none of them have ever gotten an American release. Or at least the original cut hasn't. You can get the new cut on iTunes or whatever. The quality of it is tough. I will say that. But we will.
Well, I just want to know for our listeners out there, for purposes also too, for myself, I haven't watched it yet. I'm kind of curious.
Yeah. I mean, I'm planning on watching both.
I don't think I'm.
You're
going
not
going
to be able to find the original cut through traditional means.
No, you have to. You have to be like Jay and go to the dark channels and.
Yeah, you got to go to the dark,
some
web.
Murky waters.
Yeah,
yeah. Mm-hmm. You're like a Todd Haynes film. You're in deep water.
Yeah, you gotta just tweet. Hey, can somebody find me this? Somebody will respond. You know.
Yeah, and sure also want your did, last so. Four digits of your social and all this other stuff. It's really weird stuff.
What,
anyway,
what? It's worth it. It's worth it.
It's worth it.
But
it's just
anyway,
10 minutes.
That's yeah. next week. Watch whatever version you want, but
we'll talk about.
I see a lot of similarities between that film and this one, which is only interesting because again, this film is coming right off the heels of Ashes of Time. He is mid post production on Ashes of Time while he's making this film. And we've established Wong's obsession with time and longing. So those similarities make total sense and they're very present in this film.
Oh,
but
yeah.
Also, the kind of loosely episodic nature of Chungking Express feels almost like a reaction to the very strict episodic nature of Ashes of Time. And I think both films rely heavily on dramatic ironies. Both films revolve around scorned lovers. I really do view Chungking Express as a kind of creative exhale after the frustrations he experienced throughout Ashes of Time's post-production process. And this film, right off the bat, this thing's a masterpiece, man. This is an immaculate piece of filmmaking, especially, wow. You know, the first portion of the film, it's not a half, but we'll call it the first episode of the film.
Probably like first 20 minutes of the movie.
Yeah, it's very good. Very, very good. And then the latter portion of the film is just
the movie.
Immaculate. Yeah, it's split in two, basically, with some kind of unifying settings and themes and
minor
ideas.
Tie-ins. Yeah, mm-hmm.
Exactly. But the second portion, the final portion of the film, is just some of the best filmmaking you'll ever see. Some of the most emotionally effective filmmaking you'll ever see. And this is a film that has a half dozen shots in it that just broke my brain. I mean, truly, some of the things that he achieves with the camera in this movie, it's fascinating because this is at once his most grounded film to date, but also his most stylized. It's got this extreme visual panache while also being the most grounded story that he has told yet, the smallest scale story that he has told. And additionally, it's also the first one set very firmly in urban Hong Kong, right? A lot of his other films are about, do you want to leave Hong Kong? This film, and somebody pointed this out in the book I'm reading, or it might have been, I think it was a Wong interview. He said, you know, the thing that separates this film from my past films is that these are people who are very comfortable living in the city, which is very true. And to hear him say that was pretty revelatory. And it's a film where they're kind of, they know how to cope with the loneliness better than some of the characters that we've seen in films beforehand. And this is, you know, a contemporary film, which the last two were not. And this is a film that just pops. I mean, it just pops visually. Yep. The use of music, again, takes it. It's taken to another level here with California Dreamin' and What a Difference a Day Makes. Is that the song?
I think so. Yeah. We'll talk about that.
As well as the cover of the Cranberries, which is awesome. And to me, it really, I get in this hole a lot. I don't know if you're this way, but he really captures this feeling that I often get, which is just, I'll get obsessed with one song and listen to it over and over again because it captures some way that I'm feeling at a certain time. And it just kind of ingrains itself into my brain. It just burrows in and refuses to let go. And so I just listen to it over and over and over again. And I think he does a great job of evoking that idea in this film. I mean, there's a whole lot to talk about. It's so much to talk about with this film, but it's a masterpiece, I think. This is his first masterpiece.
Yeah, Jay. I think that if I could just go right off of what you just said, talking about just the music. I think that it's such a vital tool that directors either know how to do or don't do, and know how to use it correctly. And then some directors use it very on the nose, you know what I mean? And it feels like, oh, I've heard this, I've heard these songs before, they're recycled or somebody else has them.
Just say it. Robert Zemeckis.
I don't know necessarily about Zemeckis. I mean, I know that he owns like a chunk of a soundtrack, but even like in something like Forrest Gump, there are certain songs that like you see those songs, you know what I mean? It's the lazy thing of like, anytime somebody makes a Vietnam movie, CCR's got to be in the soundtrack, right? It's the laziest sort of thing that any director, no matter how great they are or whatnot, they always
do it. Or in Flight, when they're doing heroin And they play Under the Bridge by the Red Hot Chili Peppers.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah, no, I mean, it's...
However, you could accuse California Dreaming of being very on the nose, but I think it is certainly on the nose as far as what it's saying, but there's so much subtext to it as well that it really is effective, in my opinion. I mean, it's incredibly effective.
Yeah, I was going to say this too. It's like... There are great directors, though, that they take a song and they utilize it so well that it's known with them. And something like California Dreaming, the one time that I've heard that used a lot, it's actually a different version of the song, and it's used differently in Once Upon a Time in Hollywood.
Yeah. Yeah.
It's the acoustic driving home version of it, sort of, and it's done by a different artist. And it's very melancholy. And this version, it's a sense of exactly how the Mamas and the Papas sort of sang it, which is you're hearing the hopefulness of this girl who is working in this snack shop, essentially, you know, Faye, essentially trying to use this music to motivate her to finish her mundane job. While also dreaming of an idea.
Yeah.
Yeah. And just kind of dreaming of an idea of maybe one getting out of there, but then also too, the songs in the film ultimately in Chungking Express are connections to one another. They essentially become how these characters remember. And like you're saying, Jay, anytime we listen to a song, we then connect that back to the piece of media or the time in which we remember listening to it for the first time. You know what I mean? And, you know, that's you know, I was watching recently a video behind the scenes about Goodfellas, and they were writing the script, right? And they had the script, the guy that wrote the script with Scorsese there on set, and he was taking notes as they were shooting, and they did that close-up, you know, of De Niro at the bar, and Scorsese looks at him and says, write down cream. And the guy's like, "Cream? What do you mean? You need me to go to the store or something? Like, what do you mean?" He goes, "No, write down cream. Just write it down." And then when they went into the final print to watch the whole thing, he had knew 4 months, 5 months before that he wanted that needle drop specifically in that moment. And so masters just always think six steps ahead of everybody and how they want to utilize a song. And I think these songs here are great because, and yes, they are repetitive. But they don't feel repetitive. They feel like every time they're utilized, they're perfectly utilized. Also, too, there's probably like put a giant budget, can only get three songs sort of thing, too. Always feels like that when you're dealing with Wong Kar-wai. But it's how he utilizes them when he utilizes them. Moments of silence turn into moments of jubilation. How characters reconnecting, hearing that song every single time has a different implication every time we see them.
Recontextualized.
It's beautiful in the way they're doing it. And, you know, so I was watching the film and I was just kind of sitting within it. And the first 20 minutes of the movie, I'm going, okay, what are we doing here? Like, it was it's a first chapter, and it's very different than the second half. But as you start really diving into it, it doesn't matter if you spend 20 minutes with a set of characters like we do in the first half, or you spend an hour and 25 minutes with them and learn an entire storyline, an entire love story right then and there. The sense of loneliness and isolation and wanting to be with somebody doesn't go away. You feel it. And that's what the real connective tissue is the sense of, I don't want to be alone. You know, the first cop says that at the bar to the mysterious woman. He goes,
time moves on, but the desire to not be alone is a constant.
Exactly. And the idea in those first 20 minutes, in the first story of an expiration date, and really the idea of, like, does love have an expiration date? Does longing for someone...
Does memory have an expiration date?
Does memory, exactly. Even though there is this, we all have time and we all have... clocks, and there's maybe not the moment, or it's maybe not the time in which these two can connect, and you can't manifest that. sometimes.
Christopher Nolan probably loves.
Oh my God, he does.
There's two guys who love time.
There's nobody that I think. Man, could you just imagine if they just like sat in a room together and just like hung out? Like the room would stop. You know what I mean? Like it would just like, hold on, we're not moving anything. Like these two, it would feel like everything's in slow motion behind them. Kind of like how this movie starts. But yeah. Oh, I can't wait for like the explosion sequences are probably going to be really slow in Oppenheimer. Anyway, that's beside the point.
Look, the man loves time so much. He's just made the standees at all the theaters. I just assume Nolan is in charge of the marketing for the film. There's a big clock. Just big clock.
It feels like
countdown clock.
Honestly, it feels like Fincher. You know what I mean? It feels like if David Fincher was making Oppenheimer, you would totally know he would be getting the clocks up there.
He puts the amazing Amy book in the Gone Girl packaging and stuff. And
he honestly makes
the DVD for Girl with the Dragon Tattoo look like a pirated disc.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. He makes like the Criterion Collection for Benjamin Button, the most basic Blu-ray you could ever see in your life.
Yeah, I don't know what I still don't know what the deal is.
I don't get that either. but also too, like I would feel like if Fincher would take it to the next level, then Nolan, it wouldn't be like a digital clock, it would be like an actual like grand clock. Like it would be like a Union Station, the way Fincher would want it to be like, you're putting this in every theater. I don't care. And he would make sure that clock doesn't ever like lose power, even if like the city block goes out or something.
Or if
like
Fincher
that.
Made a movie about a clock, the DVD, the Blu-ray box, it would have the big arm moving inside of the clock.
Yeah.
And the disc would be in the circle at the bottom of the arm.
See, I think the reason why we don't have a physical copy of Mank is because he's trying to find a way to how every Blu-ray or 4K can include a typewriter to be sent to somebody's house.
That one's gonna be inside a snow globe.
Oh, that's well, and then you got to crack it open.
Yep,
sounds like a mess. To be fair,
it worth like it a mess. For art.
Anyway, this movie is sneakily great. I think the thing is that
sneakily great doesn't hit you at first.
No, it doesn't hit you at first. No. I don't think that's a bad thing. For me at least, I was a little confused early on.
The first episode, if you want to call it that, I was very confused.
Yeah, and then it leads into your second episode, and then by the sort of revelations that happen, with Faye and Cop 663, played by the just absolute snacktopus that is Tony Leung in this movie. I mean, my God.
Yeah, he's 663, right?
And 663, Cop 663.
Yeah.
And you know what? I got to say, Jay, by the time they finally have, the hint of romance, and it all kind of crumbles down, and then you do the time jump. There's a little bit of a time jump. I was just like, man, this movie could keep going. I was like, I was bought in by then, and I was like, this is great. And he kind of ties in a little bit and like wink winks to the beginning chapter as well, and those characters there too. And it's kind of how they're all really connected, but then they're not really connected at the same token though. But it's not about being connected in terms of knowing each other. It's about the same ideas and the same feelings and the same longings, and that all these people may be also going to the same shop and passing by one another. And it really feels like this movie, you know, it's one of those movies where like Hollywood, like we talked about this with Altman, I used to say this to you about Altman, is that like, because he's got these large ensembles and there's an overarching theme inside of those films, that Hollywood then took those, and then that's how we get something like a Crash or various other things. You know what I'm saying?
Mm-hmm.
And same thing goes with like Magnolia and things like that. Like Chungking Express falls in a little bit in that too, for especially international cinema, because you see the sort of connected through line, but it's so subtle too. And the subtlety is what really carries it over the top. People then of course take that from its influences, because this is a very influential film. This and In the Mood for Love are his most influential films, in my opinion. Oh,
yeah. Yeah. Those are the ones on the Sight and Sound list.
Exactly. Those are on the list. And I think the reason why they are so influential is because of the fact that they're able to connect the same human experiences and emotions all together without having to beat you over the head with it. And its subtlety is really the champion here. This is a remarkable piece of filmmaking, extraordinarily subtle movie. Yes, it is. And it's very patient too. It's very, very patient. It's almost like watching one of those like English sort of costume dramas from like the, you know what I'm saying? Where like they're all Jane Austen-y sort of romances where nobody ever kisses each other or anything, but it's all looks and
directly speaks to how they're feeling.
Exactly. And that's kind of what this movie is in a lot of ways too.
That's what In the Mood for Love is for sure.
Yeah, exactly. And so, and it's just all about the subtle ways in which somebody can fall in love with another person and want to connect with them. And I think it's absolutely brilliant. Yeah. And then that final line, I mean, you know, you just ends on a goddamn high. It's so good. This movie is great. I'm not putting it in the M realm just yet. And maybe if we talk a little bit more, maybe I will, but I know you got it at 5 stars. I got it at 4.5.
Yeah, that's nothing.
I think that's fair.
Nothing to scoff at. Yeah,
nothing to scoff at there. Yeah.
No, but this film, I mean, let's talk about the first portion of the film. Let's just talk about that.
Okay.
How effective you think it is, how you think it ties into the second half of the film. I was truly watching it. I was kind of baffled by it. It starts out with this really aggressive action sequence with that technique that we've now seen from him several times. And we see similar, but almost fancier filming techniques later in the film. But
yeah,
it all starts with, you know, I was 0.01 centimeters away from this woman, and 55 hours or whatever the time was later, I'm going to fall in love with her. And he's basically speaking from the future, kind of watching the movie, which is a really fascinating way to start the movie, and also really establishes the subjectivity of time that we see in this film and, you know, a lot of his other films.
Yep.
But it ends up being about this woman in a blonde wig who is leading a drug smuggling operation, and she is betrayed by the people that are working for her and essentially told that she's going to get killed if she doesn't figure it out.
Yeah.
And she's a very lost soul. You know, she's kind of just wandering around trying to make her way, not even knowing really what's going to make her happy, because she feels so stuck in the situation that she is in. And you have this police officer, cop 233, who has just been dumped, and this is a man who is obsessed with expiration dates. He, every single day, he goes and buys this canned pineapple that expires on May 1st, which is both his birthday and the 1 month anniversary of his girlfriend breaking up with him. And he keeps saying, you know, she's going to come back to me. She's going to come back to me. I just know it. I'm going to get these countdown pineapples as kind of a good luck charm, just knowing that it's coming soon. And obviously it ends up not going that way, and you have him going down a little bit of a spiral, and he eventually meets this woman in the blonde wig. They go to a hotel room. She falls asleep. He eats a cheeseburger, and that seems like that's it. It seems like that is the entire story. It is very depressing, and you just have these people who are in, again, just stuck, because you have this police officer who always goes to the same restaurant to try and to get his girlfriend some food, and we realize that part of what happened was he keeps buying the same dish, and then is that the first half or the second half? Am I getting confused? I'm getting confused.
I think you're getting confused. I think this guy is the second half. Yeah, the first cop.
233 at the beginning has already been broken up with.
Yeah, he's already broken up with her.
Yeah.
He is, you're right about the cheeseburger and the fries.
Yeah, he definitely eats the cheeseburger at the end, and then she
But he's,
messages
but
he, him and but, says happy birthday.
But he's also like a very lonely soul because of the fact that she's broken up with him and he's calling anybody. He's calling people from like his fourth grade who he sat next to in an act of desperation to hang on to people. And this does tie into like Faye, because the shop that his girlfriend always wanted him to go to and the places he's always calling from is the same shop that Faye and what we'll see later is her relationship with 633 or 663. So, you know, in a lot of ways, the area and the place is the connective tissue, and his sense of loneliness is then what drives him to sort of get a little bit carried away and drunk and go to a bar and give his whole self to this mysterious lady who he does not know is essentially on the run for her life.
Much and darker she story.
Yeah, and she doesn't want anything to do with him because she doesn't want any attention. And they essentially, they don't even make love or anything. It's just about being together.
A sense they're about of to, and then she falls asleep, and he's exactly. just kind of like, oh, I guess this is my life now.
I guess a cheeseburger and a large plate of fries in the just middle like, of the night.
I'm not good enough for anybody. Just get me a cheeseburger. This will be the ultimate satisfaction at this moment.
Yeah, then there's like a little bit of like a there's some gunshots and people die and but it's not even like that stylized. It's not like, you know, I mean, it's kind of almost an afterthought. You know what I mean?
Yeah, the violence in that moment is pretty underplayed. I'll tell you what really threw me for a loop was the opening titles are gunshots.
Like
when the title is revealed for the movie. And I was like, whoa, I thought this was like a pretty low key, subtle movie. Now there's gunshots right away.
Do you think that this whole first section also too, in a lot of ways is a shot at, you know, obviously his first film and we talked about it was more action-y crime.
It's a Hong
his
second Kong film doesn't movie kind of,
yeah. His second film is not that audience have a mixed reaction. So this is the studio he's making Ashes to in Time, you know, right now. And it's from all accounts, essentially it's hell for him. It's
a disastrous post-production process.
I mean, anytime you have to start having multiple cuts of your film, it's never usually a good thing. You know what I mean? Like, it's never
the fact
like
that movie essentially doesn't exist is probably telling
that. Well, yeah, that too. That,
all involved kind of feel about it.
Yeah. I mean, you know, you're talking about. Yeah, you're right, Jay. I mean, like if something doesn't exist and it's on your filmography, you probably are going to have, you know, probably not want to talk about it. Probably want to move on to the next thing. But
it's his least
also,
known film. And I wouldn't be surprised if it was his most expensive film. Like it was a big movie.
But Days of Being Wild was like, there was a lot of like a reaction against it too. Mm-hmm. We know this from doing other movie series, especially when we talked about Fincher, to bring back Fincher into this a little bit. It's like Fincher notoriously made films that, you know, he had strife with the studio with and had to struggle with, especially early on. And he's brought that out even 20, 30 years later in something like, I think, like Mank, where he's taking aim at all those frustrations and being able to finally unleash
a little bit of that notoriously grumpy person to work with.
Yeah.
Difficult person to work with. Wong is
other side of the
famously calm and amenable and pleasant as far as I can tell from
also too, like you can even admit even the calmest person in the world can feel a little jaded, can feel a little frustrated.
Sure. Yeah. Yeah. And, this is his passion.
And then to be able to kind of be like, yes, those, I think for most of his films, his choices are very deliberate. And I think it is very deliberate to, and I don't know what the marketing looked like for the film at the time, but to sort of have this opening be like, oh, you're thinking you're getting another, you know, crime film, you know what I mean? Crime romance. And that's not what this movie is. And I think that that's so great. It's then like people kind of get hooked into it, you know what I mean, by the beginning, or like the bullet shots right at the beginning or whatnot, right? And then by the end, you're like a mess. And it's kind of like bleeding the best of what he's made and what we've talked about so far. And doing the best version of that is like, I can get an audience suckered in here, but what I'm really invested in is human connection time and our ability to feel absolutely broken and wanting to not be alone. And that's why I think it was such a success, is because it got people in on this basic level, and then it surprised them. And it's kind of like what it did to me. It sort of then switches the knob, and it doesn't feel like it's manipulating the audience. It's done in his beautiful, subtle way. And by the end, you sort of even forget about this first 20 minutes. And you're like, wait, there's 20 other minutes to this movie? Like, this movie was only like 80 minutes long because it was just about these two other characters at like a shop. You know what I mean? So I think that that's what's sort of great about it. And is that it's, you can look at it as it's connecting, but then you can also look at it as a subversion of expectations too.
And I've only seen the film once as of now, but apparently you do see characters from one story kind of in the background of scenes for the other story. They just kind of are floating in and out, like giving you this sensation of, you know, just passing, ships passing by in the night. These people are living such similar existences, but completely unaware of the other story going on in this world. And I do think it's an incredibly clever tool to kind of make that restaurant the center of the universe of this story. I think it really grounds the movie. And also, they just pull off some fun antics. This is at times a very fun movie. Yeah. When 663 is talking to his Garfield doll in front of his aquarium, I laugh. His love of inanimate objects is a very funny quirk that he has in this film, but also speaks to the kind of state of urban life at that time. You see this invasion of American pop culture in this film that you don't see in the other films. There's a lot of American brands that you see throughout the course of this movie. It's
like Coca-Cola is the prominent piece of bright color inside this mostly white exterior restaurant. You know what I mean?
Yeah, it's all like metallic silver and white, and then this big bright Coca-Cola advertisement.
Big bright like red Coke. You know what I mean? Mm-hmm. Like, it's very much like, well, it's of the time in which, you know, as modern as we were sort of becoming, things are becoming more global. You know what I mean? And and he's blending the past and you know, in definitely the present, because using music choices like he did in the film, like there's a modern song, there's a little bit of an older song, and then there's definitely an older song. You know what I mean? And those songs are mostly in English, you know, and which is where, you know, like culture is going back and forth, and sort of the idea of wanting to escape your mundanity for something grander.
And just a more contemporary idea of the world, kind of this blend that, you know, and the true head of the drug organization, he's an American.
Yeah.
Which I thought was very interesting. And you have,
which I noticed that and I was like, whoa. Good for him.
Have some different languages being spoken throughout the course of this film, which I thought was very interesting. And again, speaks to that contemporary setting that we have in this film. And the other thing that I was reading about, because I will admit I am not super well read on the history of politics in Hong Kong. But some of the inspiration for that expiration date motif was this countdown at the time to the end of Hong Kong as a British colony, which had this, it was like dated. It was like 1997. You are no longer a British colony. And so that was at the front of everyone's minds around the time when this movie was being made. And he weaves that into this story that's just about people's loneliness and longing.
Yeah,
which, you know, you can extrapolate that out and say that speaks to the loneliness and longing of this place that has been without its own identity for a while. And not only is there isn't just this anticipation of that happening, but there's also this, I don't know if fear is the right word, but this uncertainty surrounding it that is.
Well, when you suppress something for such a long time, Jay, right? It's you're bound to be either curious or in a bit of a crisis, you know, trying to figure out what this uncharted territory feels like.
Internal. We know we're getting rid of something that we don't want, but what is replacing it?
Yeah, no, I agree. I mean, it is for anyone that, I mean, I always say this, change is never something that human beings like. They may say they do, but change is a very scary thing to go through. And especially if you're ingrained in a culture of real romantic suppression. You know what I mean? And lack of identity, individual identity. And so, at this time, it become, they sort of get to revolutionize and create the rules that they want to, you know what I mean? And when countries have that happen, it usually tends to, like, the culture of the outside world comes in and they attach themselves to things that they never thought that they were ever going to be able to before. And I think that that's such an interesting way of doing it, because then that means that it's another form of time. It's changing. Everything changes with time. It's not going to be stuck.
And where does change happen more frequently and more furiously than anywhere else? A big city, which is a huge part of this film. And, you know, there's these great images that Wong takes advantage of, where I don't know what the camera technique is, but you have our main characters basically frozen on screen, going in slow motion as everything else is whizzing by them. They're just a blur, and you totally understand in that moment how these characters are feeling. It's such an incredible piece of visual storytelling, which is what Wong is so great at. I mean, it's I don't want to say that it's necessarily experimental, but it's so idiosyncratic, so unique to him, that it feels experimental in many ways. And I think in certain ways, this is an experimental film, especially for the time.
Yeah.
Just because of how he is dealing with the very idea of time and the idea of memory, because there is this blurring at so many points. And I've talked about this in our other reviews too. There's this disorientation that Wong establishes in his films with the way that he edits his films and jumps from one place to another, one time to another, and it really never lets you fully settle into the film, even a film that is kind of cozy. This film can be pretty cozy, and it gives you that kind of hangout vibe at certain points. And it's very fun to watch, which is what we haven't really brought up yet, it's deep and subtle and moving and thoughtful, but it's also a pretty breezy watch, especially the latter portion.
Extremely breezy. Yeah. I mean, especially when you get to, like, I think the last 40 minutes just kind of fly by. Like,
from when she starts messing with his apartment.
I was just going to say
it gets,
and also it gets
a little more straightforward.
Yeah.
And it's very fun and kind of jaunty. And the performance of Faye in this film is exquisite. She is so a little off kilter. She's got a little bit of that manic pixie dream girl thing before that was really a thing. But I think
before Zach Braff ruined it for all of us.
I think she's a much better realized character than so many examples of that kind of character. And she's so, you understand the appeal of her immediately. It really speaks to her performance as well as the direction in just the things she does, how willing she is to just march to the beat of her own drum and play that song and poke at her boss at the restaurant and try to loosen him up a little bit, because everyone in this film is sort of, they're looking for something, but they don't always know what they're looking for. And Faye is maybe the best example of that, to the point that she steals this guy's apartment key and goes and just improves his apartment. And how he doesn't kind of start connecting the dots, I don't really know, but, you know, it's okay.
One, if I could say one thing about her performance here, and the way that Faye, played by Faye Wong, is written, it's a little bit, I wouldn't call it 100% the template for like a Manny Petsu dream girl. You know what I mean? Like those feel like these girls that are unbeatable. Like Natalie Portman in Garden State is the perfect.
Flaws. Yeah.
Yeah. But I honestly, I think that she is a pretty flawed character.
Oh, it's yeah, not, for sure. She's much know, more it, layered than so
she's many of deeply them. Layered. I mean, the fact that she she is doing what she's doing and then is essentially hiding and afraid of any sort of conversation or confrontation about these emotions that she's feeling.
She'll just turn her music up.
She'll turn her music up and she'll keep it loud, or not even that. She hides from him instead of saying, I want to be with you. Let's go on a date. Let's explore these feelings. She will hide in a cupboard. She will play essentially hide and seek multiple times.
Yeah.
And he knows where she works. Like, you know, he finally figures that out and just goes and asks her, but his broken heart and his mind and his job for 663. I mean, he is essentially oblivious to it. And it's such a weird thing to do because she essentially is going to his apartment because she's holding this letter that he refuses to read from the girl that broke his heart. So she's going into his apartment and sort of learning about him really just through his things and his presence and everything. And it's unlike any relationship you really ever get to see. You're learning about the material rather than the figure itself. And she does exactly like you're talking about with the Garfield care, you know, the Garfield sort of plush toy. She does the same thing to another one that's in his house, and he's got a couple of these things too. And they're you can tell right away these two are going to be meant for each other. One, because they have a explosive chemistry between these two characters on screen.
I think Tony Leung might just have, he'd be able to have chemistry with the cardboard box.
I mean, like if he came on the Zoom right now, I mean, I would not be talking a word of English or any other language to you or him, because he is one of the most gorgeous men I've ever seen in my life. I mean, he is incredible, Jay, in this movie too.
Yeah.
I mean, he's just, it's just the way his eyes pierce through the camera's lens. It's unlike anything you could really feel. And then you kind of understand
there is that,
why Faye goes catatonic essentially around him. because he is also this, he's in a lot of ways also too this perfect representation or whatnot of what a dream guy would be, but he's deeply flawed as well. So they're both like playing almost caricatures, but then there's more deepness and darkness and sadness underneath everything that they're doing.
Yeah, absolutely. And, you know, you talked about Young's striking looks. Obviously, totally true. Undeniable. But what I've always appreciated about him is his world weariness. Even in that ending scene where he's playing the gambler, you have this feeling that this guy, yes, he's handsome. Yes, he's confident. But this guy has lived a life. This guy has lived a life, and he has a lot on his mind at any given moment. And that is also very much the case in this film, where he is dealing with this breakup. And what I think is also so remarkable about this is the chemistry he has with Faye and the chemistry he has with his ex-girlfriend in the flashback sequences, the flight attendant, are so different, but they're so electric. Both of them are so electric. You totally understand why these people fell for each other in the way they did. That scene where he's with the flight attendant for the first time and he's flying the little toy airplane around on her body and over her body and everything, that is some sensual stuff. I gotta admit, that is some that is some really spicy stuff going on there, and it is so different than so many of the other moments in the film. It's a moment where two people are really exposing themselves and are able to express their feelings in that moment in ways that characters at other parts of the film are not able to, because this is kind of the origin of that pain and the origin of that suppression. Because he felt like this the first time and then he felt so bad when it was over, he doesn't want to expose himself like he does then to Faye. And Faye similarly feels the same way, obviously. And these are people who whose desires haven't changed, but their ability to effectively seek those desires, they're non-existent now. That they just can't do it anymore because of that world weariness that I was talking about. And it all culminates in this great dramatic irony of, one, Faye herself becoming a flight attendant, telling him to meet her at a restaurant called California. She stands him up, and she becomes a flight attendant in California, the place.
Literally leaves that night. Like, yeah. Just gets on a plane and leaves. You know,
and he gets this napkin that gets soaking wet. He can barely make it out. And lo and behold, through this series of circumstances, what Faye was telling 663 in that wet, on that wet napkin, comes true through circumstances, you know, beyond that that plan that she had. Because we have 663 again returning to the center of our universe, purchasing that restaurant, and then you have Faye going to meet him. And you, for the first time in the whole movie, really feel like these are people who are going to realize the things that they want most in the world, things that really every person wants most in the world, whether they'll admit it or even whether they realize it or not. It is the most universal desire in the world, is to be loved and to find someone that you can spend your life with or coexist with in that way. And especially in a romantic circumstance like we see in so many of Wong's films. And that's such this cathartic release at the end of a film that has been so much about suppression and all of those things that Wong has become so known for. And it's really a release in a way that we have not seen in any of his movies yet. And in some of his films, he doesn't go for. Sometimes it's just like, no, I'm just going to let this bubble continue, or this balloon continue to inflate, and it's not going to burst. I'm just going to increase the pressure, the emotional pressure on you, and it's going to feel untenable at a certain point, but you're going to have to sit through it, because Wong Kar-wai is not about giving you these happy endings necessarily, because this is a much more complicated ending than the ending of Sweet Home Alabama or whatever. But this is a
Wong Kar-wai Sweet Home Alabama coming to theaters 2024.
I'd watch it. This is a much more nuanced film than that, where yes, you see these people, there's this look in their eye like, yes, let's do it. But there's also this sense of,
she's also not looking at him in that final shot either.
Yes.
You know what I mean? Like, she's still hesitant. And I mean, like, I think that the one great thing about the film, Jay, that we haven't really mentioned is the one thing that connects us all as human beings more than anything else? And communal experiences. Restaurants.
Well, the man loves food.
You know, food. Essentially, breaking bread is literally an expression. And I think that what's really telling is, like, even when Faye's working, there's that one sequence when he asks her, I think, for the date, and then the store gets really busy. She runs away, but then she gets right back to work, and she's like, you can tell that she does enjoy her job, or she's happy about what's about to happen, but she's also extremely scared. And I think when she goes there, she's not, like, trying to reunite with him. She's trying to see her uncle, and she's shocked to see him there, but it's this wonderful meet cute by the end. And She's like, where do you want to go? And he's like, anywhere that you want me to go with you with, essentially. And we don't get the cameras to pan to her. We don't see what her reaction is. We are left with his reaction. So we don't get the Hollywood romantic gesture that says, oh, happily ever after, and the birds are chirping, and Meg Ryan and Tom Hanks are together at the end of the Empire State. You know, right. Like we don't get that here. We get his version of that, which is they're still complicated human beings. And even if they figure this out, it's going to be a very complicated process because she doesn't live here anymore. She's got a job that jets her around the world.
Yeah.
He's starting a business.
But
is it really going to happen? Probably not. You know what I mean?
Oh, it very well could. I find it a little more optimistic than that.
Well, it could. I mean, it's definitely the most optimistic of his endings that we've seen so far. And reviewed so far. There's not a gun battle, and there's also not like an audience at the time like confused as hell with the last 5 minutes of Tony Leung showing up. But it's definitely also too. It's not as like you're mentioning. I don't think it's as cut and dry as what we're used to. But also like there is still the sense of like he's not pointing the camera at her. We don't get her reactions. We don't know what this is. This is not like every other movie where we think the romantic end is going to work out. Because of what we have, the evidence of the film that we've seen, the insecurities and the longing to engage in those uncomfortable but also necessary emotional conversations to get to that cathartic moment of being, I love you and you love me. Let's make this happen. Mm-hmm. We don't get that in the end. There is no bow. Because that's not how life works.
No.
Life is not that neat. And so you can project what you like, but ultimately, what has he shown you in this film?
It's not that, that is neat, going but to it's also that not that definitively bleak. You know,
no, it's not that definitive. It's not bleak, but it's just
no. But I'm just saying it's not about lives in those margins. You know,
it lives in that margins, but it's also like
those lines.
It's also like he had every opportunity at the California restaurant to have her come there and them sit down and them kiss and all that. And what does she do? She literally gets on a plane and leaves for an entire year. And it's like, also like, you're just like, wait, the logistics, he literally asked her out the morning, you know what I mean? Or earlier in the day. Like it's wild.
And that's another one where the time jump is very disorienting. And all of a sudden it felt like we were 0.01 there, centimeters away from them getting together. And then all of a sudden, boom, we're a year later, their lives are completely different.
Exactly.
But those feelings linger.
Exactly. And that's okay. I mean, it's kind of like, I mean, the best example of this, Jay, is the end of Before Sunset, where he's like, you're going to miss the train, and he goes, or you're going to miss your flight. And then he goes, but you get his reaction of him smiling, and you know, he's not going anywhere. You know what I mean? You know, he's not going anywhere. But you also know that there's going to be some complications. You know what I mean? You know what I'm saying? So, that's a more, I wouldn't say clean because we get another movie there, but here it's, there's still stuff that they have to tackle. There's still those initial conversations they're going to have if it's going to work out. So it's not bleak, but it's definitely like, it's realistic. He's very realistic. Yeah, he's very realistic with his characters here of being like, oh, if they're going to want to make this work out, she can't get on a plane and run away from these feelings.
Yeah, it's pretty grounded. That's a very grounded story, you know, except for it is heightened how she goes in and tweaks his apartment. But
yeah, we've all done weird things for love, Jay, haven't you? You know what I mean? So
yeah,
I'm sure you have. I'm sure if we got the wife on here, she'd be like, yeah.
Oh, I'm sure. Yeah, that's never.
Yeah, I don't think we need to open Pandora's box on YouTube, but you know, they have Pandora's box openings. If you actually want to go and search Pandora's box here on YouTube, they unbox those videos. So you know, and those are
We need to get in on the unboxing game.
Yeah, we really do. Yeah.
Those FYC packages.
Yeah, I'm pretty sure they like they would not want us to do that, the studios, but I don't know. Maybe nobody does them. That's actually our market.
We could corner the market.
Yeah, and rate them and be like, this studio, B. This studio, F. You know what
Netflix
I mean?
Netflix like, bombs again.
Amazon with an advent calendar. Come on. Who's got room for that? Oh, my God. You didn't get that, did you?
No, the advent calendar one, I did not.
Man, that thing was huge. That was the size of that was like the size of like a king size bed, how big that box was. Good Lord.
Yeah, I don't even get as much stuff as you, but man, I got so much junk.
Yeah, I got a lot of that stuff. I got a lot of stuff. You know, I ended up like organizing it. It spent me like an hour one night just like organizing all of it and putting stuff away. And so we got a lot of storage.
Some of them back here.
Some of them right there.
You got the Netflix ones, the Irishman book and the Power of the Dog.
I don't have any of the Irishman books or the Manx stuff.
That Irishman one is awesome. That's my favorite FYC thing I've ever gotten.
Yeah, if I could ever get the Irishman book or like, did they do a Mank book?
No, they did not do a Mank book.
They didn't do a Mank book?
They were pretty down on Mank from that's FYC perspective.
Yeah, they did. They pushed a lot of Chicago 7 stuff that year, right?
Yeah.
Yeah, nobody wants that. I don't even think Aaron Sorkin wants that. But yeah, if I ever got that Irishman book, man, that would be great. Netflix, if you're watching. You know what my address is.
You can buy
is.
It. I think it's like $170.
I'm not buying it. Somebody's going to give that to me for free. Like, and I don't want that as a gift. Folks. Nobody give that to me. I want it for free. Like, that would be great. I don't want, like, my friends like you to go out and buy me an Irishman book that's probably taking up as much space on your bookshelves as it would on mine. You know it.
Yeah.
You know it. So... I was surprised they didn't do anything for Bardo. They didn't send out anything this past year for Bardo. All it was a screener.
Yeah, just the disc. Yeah.
Could have been like a cool time to do like a mezcal or something like that for Bardo. That would have been like, get us all drunk.
Yeah.
Yeah. Honestly, anyone that sends liquor from an FYC campaign, they got my vote.
Yeah, that's a solid choice.
I'm totally kidding out there. Any voting body that's seeing this are going to probably think like I'm crazy or whatnot. But no, it's you get a lot of stuff.
They know what they're doing.
They know what they're doing. Like they're going to do it anyway, even though they shouldn't. They really shouldn't. They should just
Ryan Johnson sent us kombucha.
Jared Leto's hard kombucha.
Yeah.
I never drank it. Did you drink it?
Yeah, it's just regular kombucha.
You didn't get the beach towel that I got. With the pins, I got that.
Maybe anyway, that. Chungking Express.
Anyway, Chungking Express. Any final thoughts you have? You know who? You know what? I will say this. This is one thing I'm going to mention it now. Wong Kar-wai, not as much as he celebrated now, wasn't really celebrated a lot throughout his career.
No, this one was a grower.
He's well, not even just this one. I'm talking about like any of his movies. Even like in The Mood for Love, you think, oh, like, you know, they would submit that for the Oscar or Golden Globe maybe or any stuff like that. No. Wasn't really. An afterthought. None of his movies. He's only won one film, one prize at Cannes. He won director for Happy Together. That's the biggest major, like,
I think a lot of critics prize. Caught on.
Yeah.
Around
he's
this
definitely
time,
one but... that, like, after he, you know, by the time, I guess, he... made it over here big. He's doing my
got a little
my
bit
Blueberry
of that
Nights.
Van Gogh.
Yeah, exactly. So, yeah,
not really not recognized during his time.
Yeah,
still
which
with
is a
us.
Real damn
He'd still
shame.
Make other stuff.
Yeah, but I feel like an honorary Oscar will be down the road for him. He will definitely.
It's very one. Possible.
Very possible. Anyway, final thoughts you have on Chungking Express?
Yeah, best shot we've seen so far in the series is when 663 is at the jukebox and you see that effect that I was talking about where he's going in super slow motion putting the quarter into the jukebox everyone just whizzes by him behind him. It's this really crazy effect that I haven't really seen before. It's almost like it's strobing in front while it's whirring in the back, this kind of time lapse high speed blur effect going on. I had never, as far as I can remember, had never seen anything like that. It was awe-inspiring to me. And you know, one of my big things that I love with any movie is if I see something that I've never seen before, I think that is a huge point in the favor of any movie. And that to me just made my jaw drop. I was enthralled. It had me hook, line, and sinker at that point. It's immaculate filmmaking, original filmmaking, invigorating in so many ways. And I think it was the same for him. His devotion to naturalism here is really, I think, a great approach for him, especially in this time when he had made his least naturalistic film. The use of handheld cameras, I think, gives this film a real vitality to it, even though he's not afraid to just stick his camera down too. There's this incredible shot in the first sequence where there's this crazy canted angle. It's at like a 30 degree angle. It's just a shot of him sitting in front of the restaurant, but it just gives it this vitality in that moment to just understand compositionally how effective that will be to give the viewer something that they're totally not accustomed to seeing. And that to me has been the real revelation of this series, is how deliberate Wong Kar-wai is with every shot in his film. I think visually, aesthetically, compositionally, he's one of the greats, as far as I'm concerned, at least so far. And with the stuff that I've already seen that we still have to talk about, he's a master visualist, absolutely. And that is the case in this film more than any of the other ones that we've talked about. And I can't wait to continue to see that evolution over the course of his career, because this is like next level, and he might even end up growing as a visual stylist in that way. So it's a great, 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 great film.
Oh, any more?
Great, 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 great. Great,
great, great, great, great. All right. No, I agree with you, Jay. I mean, I think the editing in this movie is extraordinary. I think it really is. It's like his movies are just the best little containments of editing that you're going to just find in any films that you'll ever see.
So unique.
And they just are. They're just taking editing to just a different degree. And you're right. I mean, it all comes down to these shots. Like you mentioned the jukebox sequence. You know, I think of her in the apartment cleaning. There's so many shots there. I think of the shot when he's walking away outside and she yells out the window and hides. I mean, like the way
he plays. I've just been writing in my notes, just like a lot of shots.
Well, I think also the aerial play, the end there too, the final scene, the final reconnection between the two of them, the way he places the camera high up to see her reaction from his vantage point, and to see his reaction from her vantage point, and the way that the camera is positioned perfectly within their eyesights there. It's incredible. The close-ups here, absolutely astonishing by the end. I think that for me, another shot is 223 leaning on the mysterious woman at the bar, like the way that the bar is lit, the sense of sadness between those two characters, and sense of trappedness that I think that those two feel in their mundanity. I think that that's really perfectly shot there. Never seen like a plate of fries look absolutely sadder in a movie. I think that
that moment is he's really satisfied eating that burger.
Yeah.
It's just kind of this breath, this exhale that he's finally able to take.
Yeah.
And as sad as it is on the surface, it's kind of what he needed in that exact moment. And then he returns to the world, the sad world that he is inhabiting. There's multiple things going on at once, man.
No, the way that he shoots the interaction between the flight attendant, like you mentioned, the way that the plane is sort of just, he moves it up her back and uses it as like a runway
And he's got them, and he's in that moment, he's got the music going on, and then he's also got like a flight attendant announcing the instructions on a flight at the same time. It's just crazy use of sound.
Crazy mix of sound work.
That's it. That's some experimental stuff. I mean, that's crazy.
It's crazy because like you're saying, Jay, it's experimental, but yet it's vastly subtle. Also, too, you're having to catch these things in the moment. You know what I mean? And write them down. And it's honestly his most confident work that we've seen so far. It's definitely the one where you're just like,
which is funny because he was at his least confident as.
He's like, I am at like an existential crisis.
I don't know if I can do this anymore. Yeah. And then
he's essentially like, I'm hanging it up. And I'm never going to make it because this is taking a lot out of me. He was very much in a Todd Field-esque state of affair after even worse than that, because Todd Field actually enjoyed making
this movie. It's definitely got that Alien 3.
Yeah, it's got that Alien 3 vibe. He's got that Fincher, like, get me out of here and never let me stand behind a camera ever again sort of feeling. It took a lot out of him. But, you know, sometimes in exhaustion becomes clarity, and in clarity then you're able to see how you can improve, and then when you improve with a clear mind and a clear just blank slate, you can do whatever you want at that
point. He just let his instincts take over, I think.
Yeah, and that's, I think he let this do more than like a studio in this speak, which is always the best thing when a director is doing that, because when they've got this and this connecting here, It makes usually pretty special.
Well, podcast movies. Listeners, he is pointing at his head and his heart.
Yeah, exactly. Sorry, we're doing both visual and
audio-visual medium. If you want to see that in action, you got to watch it on YouTube.
You got to watch them both. Hey, you want to see me pointing at my head and my heart?
Like, I didn't get this sweet poster set up back here just for everybody to listen to the podcast.
He didn't spend a month's worth of formula just to get these posters.
Sorry,
you know I'm not wrong.
Little dude.
That's. I think that joke hit way too close to home. or just, you know, it's like a grocery store bill.
Oh, we're going back to our best movies about fatherhood podcast here, where I'm just like, oh my god, fatherhood is impossible.
All right. Well, that is our review of Chungking Express. I know that JD will be watching it on his sabbatical. He'll have thoughts on our Letterboxd page at letterboxd.com/InSessionFilm. If you want to follow us on Facebook, Twitter, and Instagram, you can do so by searching In Session Film. Just give us a good follow over there. You're here already on YouTube. If you are here on YouTube and listening, you can like, review, and subscribe. Just hit below. Hit that stuff down below. And if you're listening to us on a podcast, well, you know, subscribe to us. Also go to iTunes. Leave us a review. We love reviews. We'll read them out on a future episode of the main show. Maybe we'll do that on a mailbag episode down the road. I'm sure we're going to do a mailbag episode at a certain point of that show. Our show is syndicated every week. Geekcast Radio and the Lamb Podcast Network, right, Jay? We're also
absolutely.
We also have the In Session Film Store, where you can
Patreon
over there. Patreon.com/InSessionFilm.
That's really the most
Patreon.com/InSessionFilm. We'll have some bonus content coming up there soon. All our bonus content plus some other good stuff is over there as well. The mobile app, you can get that InSessionFilm.com/apps. The In Session Film Store, you can go on the website InSessionFilm.com. All right, Jay, well, what are we doing next week?
Ashes of Time.
Ashes
of
Time.
We talked to podcast.
We kind of did kind of mention a lot of it, but you haven't watched it yet, right?
I've watched one cut.
Okay, I haven't watched it yet, so I'm doing just the theatrical cut.
I don't know. If you watch it and you're like, I don't think this is worth talking about, maybe we don't talk about it. I don't know.
Maybe we just skip it. I don't know.
We'll play it by ear. We'll play it by ear. I'm planning on talking about it. I'm planning on talking about it. You're right. We got to do them all.
I mean, even if it's shorter, maybe we do two next week. Maybe we make up. Maybe if that one's a little bit shorter, then we.
Maybe it'll be a little shorter. That's all right. I don't know. I actually think there's a lot to talk about with it.
Yeah, well, then after that, you know, if all we right, want to do maybe
it.
Two.
We're doing it.
Ashes of Time, and then, you know, maybe if we have extra time, maybe we'll do Fallen Angels next week. Who knows?
Yeah. Right?
Maybe if we got the time. Who knows? You got the money. Who I got the time.
Knows?
Any final thoughts? Anything before we wrap this one up? You got anything?
Yeah, Cranberries cover is good.
No, the Cranberries cover is good. Man, that's a good song. They really should. They really should have more Cranberries. And not just be at Thanksgiving. Have more Cranberries and everything. You know what I mean?
Yeah, I'm with you. Absolutely.
So, well, with that, thank you all for listening. Thank you all for watching. We'll see you all next time. Go and get a ticket on the Chungking Express. Let's go!